The Katra Podcast Conversations for the Curious Essential Knowledge Simplified, your gateway to essential ideas that matter most. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of the Katra AI. Welcome back to the Deep Dive. Today, we're embarking on, well, quite a profound exploration. We're tackling a text that's more than just a book of faith. It's really a complete system of life, law, guiding over a billion people worldwide. We're talking about the Quran, the central religious text of Islam.
Yeah, it's absolutely essential, I think, for anyone wanting to understand global cultures, ethics. Our mission today is to navigate this really extensive scripture, try and pull out the core insights, the wisdom. It's much more than just a spiritual guide. It places a huge emphasis on social justice, on economic ethics, and offers, well, a detailed blueprint for community harmony.
Exactly. And the sources really show why this deep dive is so relevant now. The Quran tackles these timeless, critical human questions. What's our purpose here? How should we handle things like power, wealth? And maybe most critically, how do we build a society that's genuinely equitable and just? I mean, it laid down some radical challenges to the structures back in 7th century Arabia. And frankly, it continues to challenge many of our, you know, modern economic and social assumptions today.
Absolutely. But before we really dive into the text itself, we have to address something unique about it. Its authorship. Or rather, the claim about its authorship.
Right.
For Muslims, the Quran isn't just inspired writing. It's attributed to divine authorship, considered the literal verbatim word of Allah, God the Creator.
And that distinction is just paramount, isn't it? The main human figure involved is the Prophet Muhammad ibn Abdullah. He lived from about 570 to 632 CE. His role was as the recipient, the messenger of this revelation. But critically, he wasn't the composer, not the author of the text itself.
And that detail really underscores the belief. Muhammad was born in Mecca, known well before his prophethood for his integrity. They called him Al-Amin, the trustworthy. Believers often point out that the sheer depth, the linguistic beauty, the comprehensive nature of the text, covering everything from, you know, cosmology to law, well, it seems beyond the capacity of an unlettered man from that time and place. For them, that's evidence of its divine origin.
And the way it was preserved, incredibly meticulous, ensuring it survived. Key companions like Zayd ibn Thabit worked very closely with the early caliphs, Abu Bakr, Umar, Uthman,
right,
to collect, verify, and standardize both the written fragments and the parts memorized by the community. This whole process ensured that a single authentic version was established early on and preserved across the centuries.
Great. So let's try and unpack the central message. If we kind of strip it all back, the absolute core thesis is establishing Tawhid. That's absolute pure monotheism.
The absolute oneness of God.
Exactly. The absolute oneness and uniqueness of God. And this belief system, it immediately translates into a way of life, Islam, which literally means willing submission to that one divine will.
So the Quran positions itself as the final, complete, and uncorrupted message. It sees itself as confirming the true original messages that were delivered by earlier prophets, figures like Abraham, Moses, Jesus, but clarifying them, restoring the pure monotheism.
And what's really fascinating is just the sheer scope of the book. It intends to bridge that gap we often create between the spiritual and the practical everyday world.
Yeah.
It functions all at once as a source for worship, for ethical law, philosophy, social governance. The intended audience is universal, and it really challenges that idea that religion is just for private personal reflection.
And it constantly invites you, the reader or listener, on this kind of intellectual journey. The text repeatedly calls for reflection tafakkur on the signs, the ayat, that you see in creation.
Like the sun, the moon.
Exactly. The cycle of the sun and moon, the complexity of life coming from water. It pushes you to look at the world itself as a book filled with evidence, you know?
And it uses stories, narratives, not just for, like, entertainment, but as moral instruction. You get these detailed historical accounts of earlier prophets.
Mm-hmm.
And they're used as parables.
Mm-hmm.
The idea is for the listener to extract practical lessons about faith, about obedience, accountability, making the wisdom feel immediate, applicable to your own life.
Okay, so let's get into the structure of the text itself. It's organized into 114 chapters called surahs. They're generally arranged by decreasing length, which is interesting in itself. But to really get the content, you have to understand the historical context specifically, the difference between the Meccan and Medinan revelations.
Precisely. Yeah. That's crucial. The Meccan revelations came early on, when the Prophet Muhammad and his small group of followers were, frankly, a persecuted minority in Mecca.
Right.
So these surahs tend to be shorter, more poetic, very intense. They focus on the absolute core tenets: Tawhid, the belief in resurrection, basic morality. Think about the very first command revealed in Surah Al-Alaq, chapter 96. It was the revolutionary call, Iqra, read.
A command for knowledge right at the start.
Exactly. But then the whole situation shifts drastically with the migration to Medina. This marks the beginning of the Medinan revelations. The community wasn't just a minority group anymore. They established a state, a functioning society.
So they needed laws, structure.
Exactly. Suddenly, the focus wasn't just on belief, it was on governing. So these later surahs are typically longer, and they deal heavily with legislation, social organization, community ethics, even rules of engagement and conflict. They're building a society based on those earlier Meccan theological foundations.
Okay, so to give an example of that Meccan focus, maybe Surah Al-Ikhlas, the sincerity.
Definitely. A perfect example. It's incredibly powerful, just four verses, but it's considered such a definitive statement of Tawheed that it's said to be theologically equivalent to like a third of the entire Quran.
Wow.
It declares God is one, the eternal, absolute refuge. He doesn't beget, nor is he begotten. And there's nothing comparable to him. It's just the purest statement of singular, absolute monotheism you can imagine.
And then maybe the most recited chapter, Surah Al-Fatiha.
The cornerstone, really. Recited in every single daily prayer. It functions as the essential prayer, praising God, acknowledging his sovereignty over everything, and immediately asking for guidance. Guidance to the straight path.
It's like a constant reorientation.
Exactly. A concise summary of our dependence on the divine, seeking that right way forward.
Okay, so shifting gears to that Medinan legislative framework. The big one is Surah Al-Baqarah, the cow, right? The longest chapter.
That's the one. It really establishes the foundational structure for the Muslim community, the Ummah. It codifies the practical pillars of Islam, things like prayer, salat, fasting, psalm, charity, zakat, pilgrimage, hajj. And it introduces fundamental laws about family, contracts, marriage, divorce, finance.
And that financial part is huge, especially the prohibition of riba, usually translated as usury or interest.
Yes, and it's crucial to understand this isn't just some technical banking rule. It's a really radical statement against economic exploitation.
Yeah.
Well, the core idea is that money shouldn't just multiply on its own without contributing to genuine productive activity or sharing in the risk. It's an economic philosophy deeply rooted in fairness and preventing wealth concentration just through lending.
And nested within this long chapter, Al-Baqarah, you find something purely spiritual, right? The throne verse.
Yes. Ayat al-Kursi, verse 2.255. It provides this incredible spiritual grounding for all these complex laws. It's probably one of the most memorized and recited verses in the entire world. It affirms God's absolute power, knowledge, sovereignty over heavens and earth, assuring believers that all their efforts in building this just society are ultimately rooted in this eternal divine reality.
So it's not just laws, but also deep narrative. You mentioned Sir Yusuf Jaysuf earlier. It's called the best of stories in the Quran itself.
It is. And it's remarkable because it's one of the few surahs that tells one continuous story from beginning to end. It's a profound narrative about human emotions, jealousy, betrayal, hardship, but also political intrigue, resilience, and ultimately divine wisdom and triumph.
What's the main lesson there?
It's really a masterclass in psychological and moral growth. It highlights the virtue of sabr, often translated as patience, but it's more like active perseverance, steadfastness through really difficult times. And the climax, Joseph forgiving his brothers who wronged him so terribly, it powerfully demonstrates how divine wisdom can work through even the worst of human actions to bring about a greater good.
And to kind of bring things full circle, there's Surah Al-As, the declining day. It's incredibly short, just three verses, but offers a really potent summary.
It's profound. It essentially says that all of humanity is in a state of loss, except for those who have faith, who do righteous deeds, and this is key, who enjoin upon each other truth, al-haq, and patience, asab.
So individual salvation isn't enough. It requires community.
Exactly. It emphasizes this interconnected mutual responsibility. You need faith and good works, yes, but also actively encouraging truth and resilience within the community. It's a powerful summary.
Okay, so moving from specific chapters to the overarching themes, it seems like they all flow from that core concept you mentioned first, Tawheed.
They really do. Absolute monotheism is the bedrock. And the most immediate powerful consequence of accepting Tawheed is universal equality.
How does that work?
Well, think about it. If there's only one creator, and only that creator deserves ultimate devotion and service, what happens to all the human-made hierarchies? Status, wealth, tribe, race. they lose their ultimate significance.
They collapse, theoretically.
Right. This principle is seen as liberating humanity from servitude to anything created. We're all equally servants of the one creator. That's the foundation for universal human equality in this worldview.
And that connects directly to the next huge theme, which is social justice and equality in practice.
Absolutely. The Quran is relentless in condemning exploitation, oppression, hoarding wealth. It commands believers to actively protect the vulnerable orphans, the poor, the needy, travelers. It fundamentally challenges social systems based on inherited status or accumulated wealth, asserting that the only true measure of human worth in God's eyes is taqwa piety, God consciousness, righteous conduct.
That's a radical reordering of values, especially for its time. And it wasn't just talk, right? There were mechanisms.
Precisely. Which leads us to another theme. Balance and moderation, known as wasatiyah. This is often misunderstood as just finding a simple middle ground or compromise.
But it's deeper.
Much deeper.
Yeah.
Wasatiyah is more like navigating an ethical path between harmful extremes. It challenges both excessive materialism, where this world is everything, and extreme asceticism, where you totally abandon worldly responsibilities.
So, not running away from the world, but engaging with it ethically.
Exactly. It calls for an engaged spirituality. Fulfilling your duties in the world, family, work, community, while maintaining your spiritual connection and ethical compass. It's about integrating, not separating.
And a final theme, which feels very relevant today.
Right.
Environmental stewardship, or khalifa.
Yes. Humans are described as khalifa on earth, trustees, stewards, vicegerents. This role comes with immense responsibility to maintain the balance, mizan, of creation.
What does that mean practically?
Well, it includes a strong prohibition against wastefulness, israf, in all things. And it implies actively promoting the sustainable use of resources, caring for the natural world as a trust from the creator. It's a very clear environmental ethic embedded in the text.
These are big ideas, and the sources highlight specific verses that really capture them powerfully.
They do. The language can be incredibly concise and potent.
Let's look at a few. Starting with that very first revelation, read, "In the name of your Lord who created," 96.1.
It's foundational. It establishes the pursuit of knowledge, learning, reading, understanding as a fundamental religious duty. It directly links the act of learning about the world to recognizing the creator. It's not faith versus reason. It's faith demanding reason and knowledge.
Then there's the standard for justice. O you who believe, stand out firmly for justice as witnesses to Allah, even if it be against yourselves, your parents, and your relatives. 4.135.
I mean, just pause on that. Stand for justice, even if it's against yourself.
Or your own family.
That's an incredibly high bar. How do you even practice that? The verse frames justice not as a social contract, primarily, but as a testimony to God. It's an absolute obligation that transcends personal loyalties, self-interest, everything. It has to be impartial.
And related to justice, the value placed on life itself. And whoever saves a life, it is as if he has saved all of mankind. 5.32.
Yeah, that just completely reframes our perspective, doesn't it? It emphasizes the infinite sacred value of every single individual human life.
Yeah.
Saving one is like saving everyone.
And finally, on the matter of belief itself, there is no compulsion in religion. The right course has become clear from the wrong. 2.256.
This is a cornerstone for religious freedom within the Islamic framework. It states very clearly that genuine faith, authentic belief, has to come from sincere personal conviction based on clarity. It cannot and should not be coerced.
So all this guidance, the laws, the ethics, the stories, it's not meant to just stay in the book, right? It's designed for real-life application.
Absolutely. It's intended to shape daily life. On a personal level, think about the 5 daily prayers, Salat. They provide this regular structure throughout the day. Moments for mindfulness, for disconnecting from the mundane, reconnecting spiritually. They encourage gratitude, shukr, and a kind of continuous moral self-assessment.
And economically. Beyond just avoiding riba.
Well, the prohibition of riba, along with strong commands against fraud, cheating in weights and measures, breaking contracts, all this promotes a framework for professional integrity, for fair trade. The ideal is an economy based on equity, shared risk, mutual benefit, not parasitic extraction.
And for the community?
The system of zakat, the obligatory annual charity, is fundamental. It's not just voluntary giving. It's a mandated right of the poor and the wealth of the rich. It creates a systematic redistribution of wealth, aiming to provide a social safety net, reduce inequality, and foster active community service for those in need.
And looking even wider globally.
The Quran explicitly recognizes shared roots with other people of the book, specifically Jews and Christians. And there's a famous verse that says, humanity was created in diverse tribes and nations, not to despise each other, but that you may know one another. 49.13. This actively counters tribalism and, ideally, provides a theological basis for interfaith dialogue, understanding, and global cooperation.
As we sort of wrap up this deep dive, reflecting on all this, what surprised me most looking at the sources was the sheer integration, the holistic nature of it, how spirituality and really practical everyday wisdom are completely interwoven. Hmm. There's no real separation between, you know, the sacred and the secular, the spiritual and the worldly. It seems every action, whether it's conducting business fairly or even just not being wasteful, can become an act of worship if done with the right intention, the right consciousness. It's such a unified, purposeful way of looking at life.
That's a great takeaway. And perhaps for you, the listener, the lasting insight is how the Quran presents this paradigm shift towards a life defined by purpose and accountability. It constantly hammers home that individual transformation, working on yourself, and social reform, working to build a just community, are not separate things. They're deeply interconnected, inseparable processes.
You can't have one without the other, really.
Exactly. And the unique claim, the powerful value proposition, is that this guidance, this wisdom, is presented as timeless, as transcending human limitations and historical contexts. And maybe a final thought to leave you with, this integration of the call to reflect and use reason alongside divine guidance. It offers a really interesting framework for intellectual and spiritual development, one that definitely warrants more exploration than we could cover today.
See you next time with another remarkable thinker, another powerful book, and another idea that has shaped our world. This audio summary is brought to you by Akatra Foundation.